This is Investor IQ on News Radio 570 WWNC.
All right, well, we're back with Larry Hartley, who's an attorney with Strauss & Associates. My name is Glenn Wessel. I'm the host of Investor IQ. And if you'd like to send some questions to me, I'd be glad to consider them. The easiest way to do that is just to Google my name, Glenn with two N's, Wessel with two S's. You'll find our firm. We're in Asheville. Click on the Contact Us link at the top of our website and send a note, whatever you'd like. If you use too many swear words, I'll have someone else read it. But we'll read everything that you send, so I'll be glad to look at all that. So, Larry, last time when we were speaking about the various types of documents, you mentioned a durable power of attorney versus a general power of attorney, and I suppose you could have mentioned a limited power of attorney. Share with our listeners what the distinction would be.
Sure. Powers of attorney come in various forms for different purposes. A typical limited power of attorney might be where you're appointing a realtor to help close on a piece of real estate when you can't attend the closing yourself, and it's limited to one specific purpose or a couple of limited purposes. A general power of attorney is typically a broadly powered written document that gives broad powers to the agent to act on your behalf. Most of the time, those documents are also written to be what is called durable, which means that if you become incapacitated, the agent still has the authority to continue to act while you're incapacitated. I have seen, though, you have to be careful, because some general powers of attorney are not durable, and the agent ceases to have authority if you go in a coma or in a bad accident and can no longer supervise them.
And there are certain formalities that have to be observed when you execute such a document. I think, at least when I was studying this topic, not as an attorney, of course, but there's something called the equal dignity rule, where I believe that it has to match in some manner how you take possession of your power. Is that correct?
Well, the formalities do have to be followed, and the pitfall is that they can vary from state to state. For example, here in North Carolina, a durable power of attorney only requires that the principal, the person signing the power of attorney, execute it in front of a notary public and provide sufficient identification. But some states will require witnesses. To our south, for example, South Carolina requires two witnesses. And so you do want to make sure that your documents are executed properly for the place where they're going to be used.
Mm-hmm. And what about all these attorney-in-a-box software programs? Now, I'm sure that you're in competition with that, just like I'm in competition with financial planners in a box. But try to offer some objective guidance about what the pitfalls might be.
The attorney-in-a-box program softwares, in my opinion, it's better to have executed something out of one of those documents than to have nothing at all. But that being said, they often fall short for many family situations. Again, I've seen powers of attorney where the section that made it durable was not executed, for example. Or I've seen wills prepared by someone on their own without the help of an attorney, and it did not meet the family's needs. For example, it did not address the disabled beneficiary's problems of being on a government program, or it did not address a state tax reduction for folks with larger estates.
Right. Thank you. when it comes to drafting a will, there's another document called a living will, which I believe you referenced already. What is the distinction there?
The living will is actually a healthcare document. It's somewhat of a misnomer. It's also known as a declaration of desire for natural death. And this is a short document wherein the person designates their desires regarding end-of-life situations, such as a permanent coma or a terminal illness at the end where everything has been done and they're not going to recover from it. Or also in North Carolina, a third situation is advanced dementia. Mm-hmm. One of the things about advanced dementia, at the end, a person can actually lose the ability to swallow. And at that point, the only way to give them sustenance is through feeding tubes. Well, many people don't want that, and they need to execute a living will that that expresses their desire not to have that, or to have the feeding tubes removed, or the extraordinary measures removed, if that is their desire.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And when it comes to having a trust drafted, there are countless types of trust, but I think there are two broad categories of trust. One would be revocable, and one would be irrevocable. If you could just briefly touch upon the differences, because I believe that they're completely different animals.
Sure.
Is that right?
A revocable trust is easily changed by the trust maker, and it is often used as a will substitute in order to avoid the expenses and the headaches of probate systems after death, but it also is a superior way to manage assets for the trust maker if the trust maker is still alive but now incapacitated. In other words, it kind of fulfills some of the requirements or uses of a durable power of attorney and also of a will, and it has many advantages of additional privacy, ease of use, and broad acceptance. An irrevocable trust, on the other hand, is very difficult to change. It is not designed to be changed after the trust maker creates it. It is designed to fulfill other purposes, such as Medicaid qualification, or reduce estate taxes, or for other purposes.
You mentioned the term will substitute. If you could just expand upon that a little bit, because I know that if you name a beneficiary, let's say a life insurance policy or a joint account, you're circumventing your will, so to speak. Is that right?
Certainly. Those are other will substitutes also, and you have to be very careful when you're designing your estate plan to make sure that these various documents do not circumvent the way you want things to go. For example, if you have your children listed as the beneficiary of your will, but you still have your ex-wife listed as the beneficiary of a life insurance policy, the children may not end up with that life insurance policy.
That's right. In the third segment, which will be coming up in just a moment, I hope to have you share with us some of the pitfalls that you may have seen or heard about as an estate planning attorney. For the time being, though, before we get there, please just explain what it is that the federal estate tax is, because there's a lot being kicked around in Congress with respect to what that tax system is going to look like sometime from now.
Sure. The federal estate tax is essentially a tax that redistributes wealth after death for folks with larger estates. We currently have the largest federal estate tax exemption that we've ever had. It's sitting at $3.5 million. It's scheduled to go away next year, but we don't think that's going to happen. And the year after that, in 2011, it's scheduled to drop back down to the $1 million level.
In essence, it sunsets to a previous law that had been in effect in, what, 2003?
Previous
or so?
To 2001,
actually. 2001, okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. All right. Well, we've been meeting with Larry Hartley. He's a specialist in all matters of estate planning. And you can reach Larry at 258-0994, and I believe the website for your firm is Strauss Law.
www.straußlaw.com.
So we'll be back in just a moment. I'm Glenn Wessel.